All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show. Hi, and welcome back to Making the Argument with Nick Freitas. Today, we're going to be going behind the scenes on how lobbyists affect legislation and how they interact with your representatives. We're also going to be making the argument on cronyism versus capitalism. Is cronyism a feature of capitalism, or is it a departure from it? And then finally, we're going to be talking about things that make America great with a very interesting, very inspiring story of James J. Hill and the Great Northern Railroad, all coming up next.
One thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
Okay, behind the scenes with lobbying. I mean, lobbyist has almost become a bad word in political culture right now and in public discourse. And the thing I want everyone to understand about lobbying, right? Anytime you call up your representative and you try to change their mind or get them to think something differently about a particular policy issue, you're engaging in lobbying. So lobbying in and of itself is not a bad thing, right? Just like lobbyists in and of themselves are not bad people or bad organizations. A professional lobbyist is someone that that's what they do for a living. That's their career. And a lot of times these people are either former legislators or they're former staffers. They're people that kind of understand the dynamic within a particular legislature. They understand the processes to go through. And so a lot of times those groups like Family Foundation or Gun Owners of America, you know, they do a really good job of providing legislators with information and a perspective on a different way or a particular way of thinking about a policy position, right? So in and of itself, it's not bad. Where it gets bad is when a lobbyist or a lobbying group tries to apply pressure in a way that is dishonest in order to try to almost threaten a legislator into doing something that they probably shouldn't do, or only showing one perspective without being able to have a reasonable conversation about other concerns. And look, I have had the full spectrum of interaction with various lobbyists during my time in the General Assembly. I've had lobbyists that kind of do that quasi, you know, hey, Nick, we'd really like you to vote a certain way on this. And oh, by the way, did you get a campaign donation? At that point, I love to tell them, okay, here's what you need to understand about me. This conversation is over, and whatever check you're sending, I'll be happy to send it back right now, because you are never going to get me to vote a certain way because you think you've given me a campaign donation. I absolutely despise that. A lobbyist has an obligation to make a good, logical argument for their position on a piece of policy. The moment they try to add money into the situation, I get furious. I get furious. And in fact, in Virginia, we've passed laws to where it's like, you are not supposed to do that. And for good reason, right? You're not supposed to, like, for instance, when I'm sitting in session, we're not allowed to take any campaign donations. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing. We should not be talking about those things amidst policy. And quite frankly, any legislator that takes money from a lobbying organization or from any organization in order to influence their decision is someone that you should kick out of office immediately, right? So one of my interactions with some people that came to lobby me, we were talking about health insurance. And their big thing was they wanted me to vote for a bill that was going to outlaw certain types of health insurance. And the way that they actually described it to me was, well, this is preventing junk insurance policies. And so I stopped him for a second. I said, okay, you know, respect you, respect the organization you're coming from, respect what you want to achieve. I said, but let me get this straight. you are classifying this particular type of insurance as junk insurance because it doesn't cover a couple things that you want covered. Is that correct? And they said, yes, that's it. I said, okay. So instead of allowing people to decide whether or not they want that insurance policy, and maybe the reason why they want that insurance policy is because it's something they can actually afford. And if the government requires that company to add these other things, they can no longer afford to provide a plan that is affordable to somebody. You want me to make that decision instead of the consumer? Like, why would I do that? And like, well, it's going to protect the consumer. I said, okay, but wait a second. Shouldn't they have the ability? Shouldn't the consumer have the ability to look at different insurance policies and decide which one fits best for them and which one fits into their budget? And their answer, honestly, was no. No, the government should decide what insurance companies should cover. It shouldn't be the consumer. And I said, okay, on what level do you actually think you're protecting the consumer at this point? Because all I see is that you're taking away options away from them. And we had this conversation back and forth for a while. And, you know, again, it's not like I changed their mind. They certainly didn't change my mind, but everyone was respectful with one another. I had another case where somebody came in and I was carrying legislation to try to reduce government restrictions on a particular industry. And this lobbyist had convinced the people that he was bringing in that I was like destroying their industry, that I was actually going to get rid of it in Virginia. And I'm sitting here explaining to this person how, no, all I'm doing is removing the regulatory barriers and the fees that you have to pay. Like you can still freely engage in the marketplace and in the economy. You can do all that stuff. I'm just going to remove the annual fees you have to pay to the state because, you know, I think you proved in yourself, you're qualified. People are buying products and services for you. They're happy with the products and services. So why should you have to keep coming back to the state to get permission to provide these services? And she was adamant. She's like, no, you're going to destroy our industry. And I'm looking over at the lobbyist and I'm thinking to myself, you know, this person, I don't think came up with this idea on their own, right? This lobbyist was essentially telling them, you've got to put pressure on Delegate Freitas because he's going to destroy your industry. Nothing could be further from the truth, right? Nothing in my bill would have outlawed what they were doing. Nothing in my bill would have restricted what they were doing. Nothing in my bill would have added increased fees to what they were doing. In fact, it was removing all of those things. But because a lobbyist had convinced this person that I was going to destroy their industry, now all of a sudden this person is scared and they're operating from a position of fear instead of from a position of information. And that is a bad case of lobbying. That is intellectually dishonest because they weren't sharing a perspective. I had answers for every single question that they brought forward to me. I had ways that we could negotiate through some of their concerns, but ultimately they were operating from a position of fear. And whenever I see a lobbyist manipulate the people that they're working with in order to do something like that, or to make bad arguments, or to misunderstand what the bill actually does, I remember that. And the next time that lobbyist comes into my office, I'm sorry, I'm not going to trust them. And because that's one of the things that's so critical, right? A good lobbyist understands that they're there to provide a perspective. They are there to provide insight on behalf of the industry or the people or the constituency that they're assisting. Right, their job is not to manipulate the process or make people, you know, fearful for no reason in order to get what they want, so they can have a higher scorecard back at the lobbying firm. You know, by the same token, I've had people that came in. Again, Gun Owners of America is a really good example where we were looking at a particular anti-gun policy, and I knew where I stood on the positions. I'd done a lot of research on it, but they provided some additional research on court cases that were taking place in other portions of the country that I wasn't aware of at the time that actually, you know, added some more, you know, intellectual rigor and power to the overall argument that we were making in defense of the Second Amendment. So the thing that I would tell you about lobbyists in general is it's like any other, you know, sector of the economy or any other person, right? They're as good or as bad as their intentions and the way they conduct business. And provided they can be open and honest and rational, then great, we can have a good conversation, and I'm happy to hear the perspective that you're bringing to the table. But the biggest problem that I have with lobbying in general, right, or with certain lobbyists, I should say, is not so much with the lobbyist as it is with the legislator. Because I've seen people where they change their mind based off of whichever lobbyist left their office last. and they can't seem to find any sort of coherent philosophy which informs their position. You know, I've gotten to the point right now where the lobbyists in Richmond, they know where I stand on issues. And if they're going to come and they're going to talk to me about something, they're not going to sell me on something because they gave a really slick presentation. They're going to have to explain how their particular policy or their particular bill protects individual liberty, protects property rights, lowers taxes, makes it easier to conduct business. If they can't do that, I mean, I'll hear your perspective, but don't expect me to change my mind either by threatening me or trying to entice me somehow. So I would say that if you have a problem with the amount of control that lobbyists have, here's what I would recommend. Vote for better people, right? Because if you don't go in, if you do not go into politics with a coherent philosophy, a coherent worldview, which informs your thinking and your decision-making process, then you're someone that is just going to be blown by the winds no matter where they're coming from. And some of these lobbying organizations represent a lot of people. They have a lot of power. They have a lot of money. And again, if you're not willing to stand on your principles for something, if you're not willing to push back and say, look, I don't care what the consequences are for this because this is the right thing to do, then the problem is with the legislator, right? And that's why we need to be so, you know, informed with respect to what our legislators actually believe and how are they going to operate in a tense or a potentially hostile situation. And so, again, as you look at lobbying in general, you look at the profession of lobbying, yeah, there's a lot of things that we should, you know, be on the lookout for, and there's a lot of things that we should be aware of. But ultimately, one of the primary reasons why lobbyists have such power is really because the government has a great deal of power over the economy. And P.J. O'Rourke had this great statement that I loved. He goes, when you put politicians in charge of buying and selling, the first thing to be bought and sold will be politicians. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more in making the argument with cronyism and its effect on politics and its effect on the economy. But that's the one thing I would leave you with. There's good lobbyists. There's bad lobbyists. There's lobbying organizations where, you know, I don't agree with anything that they're coming to me, but they're honest. Fine. We can have a good conversation and I'm happy to hear your perspective. Right. But don't think you are ever going to threaten me or entice me to vote away from my principles or the things that I told my constituents that I believed when I got here. And you know what? It's not that hard to do. It's not that hard to look at a lobbyist and say, look, there's nothing you can offer me to violate my principles. And what I've also found is that most lobbyists, not all, most lobbyists respect that. Some lobbyists then try to come back and run it. They will actually finance attack ads against you and everything else. And one of the things I was really proud to see is a few years ago in the General Assembly, we were trying to deal with certificate of public need reform. We were trying to say that, look, it's not fair when somebody wants to set up a clinic or they want to provide medical services in an underserved area that these big lobbying groups come in and try to shut it down through certificate of public need, and we need to reform this process. And the lobbyists started to understand that we weren't going to budge on this. It was the right thing to do, and we were going to do it. And if you want proof that it was the right thing to do, take a look at the fact that during this coronavirus, we actually suspended COP laws in Virginia because we knew it was bad for access to healthcare, right? But this lobbyist, what did he do? He started going out into all of our districts and running all these horrible attack ads, which were completely disingenuous. Now, there were some people that were feeling the pressure for those. And we all got together and we said, look, we are either going to be representatives of the people or we're going to be representatives of a lobbying firm every time they scare us. And so we expect everyone to stand strong on this and to send a powerful message to this particular lobbying group that you try to come in and intimidate us. It's one thing to try to reason with people. It's one thing to try to argue and make a good argument for something. It's another thing to try to intimidate someone into doing what you want. And we did. We stood strong and we sent a powerful message that you are not going to come with that sort of attitude and that sort of behavior when it comes to trying to get what you want out of the legislature. Again, make a good argument. Make an honest argument. Don't try to intimidate. Don't try to entice. Right? So that's a little bit with lobbyists behind the scenes and how it affects legislation. All right, cronyism versus capitalism. And a lot of times you'll hear people use these terms like crony capitalism, right? They put them together. Whenever somebody does that, I always remind them that, well, actually, the moment you engage in cronyism, you're actually violating the tenets of capitalism or of free markets. So let's define our terms, right? First of all, what is cronyism? Cronyism is essentially when a private business or some sort of enterprise is getting special privileges, protections, subsidies from the government at the expense of their competition, right? And the reason why the cronyist or crony capitalism doesn't really make sense to me as a term is because capitalism really is based on the private ownership of production, the means of production, through voluntary exchange, which again is just, I have property, you have property. And the only way we exchange that property is if we both agree to it, right? And the only way we're going to do that is if we both perceive some sort of mutual benefit. So one of the things that businesses will sometimes do is instead of going to the customer or just engaging in open competition, they'll go to the government and they'll get, again, they'll get a subsidy, which is basically just politicians giving that company your tax dollars. Or they'll write some sort of regulation, which makes it more difficult for other companies to be able to compete with them. There's actually this myth that all businesses don't like regulations. They don't like fees. They don't like taxes. Now that's true to some level, right? No business likes regulations, fees, or taxes that are harming their business. But what you do see happening quite a bit in the legislative process is you'll see a particular business within an industry that doesn't want to compete with a new innovator or with a smaller business that's more agile or has come up with a new idea or a way to do things. And so they'll go to the government and they'll say that, well, look, you know, our industry is so important that we need subsidization from the government. You know, we need tax dollars because we employ so many people. And so they'll make it more about jobs as opposed to them trying to push out their competition. Or they might come and they say, you know what, gosh, this industry is really important, but we need some regulations in order to ensure that we have better public safety. And then the company writes up the legislation and hands it to a legislator with the idea that, oh, this is going to keep people safer. You know, or that same business goes in and makes a huge campaign contribution, or the business puts a big plant within the congressional district or whoever the person is that represents that area. So these are all ways that businesses can actually collude with the government in a very anti-competitive fashion in order to give themselves a competitive advantage, right? So when we talk about cronyism, that's what it is. And cronyism is not capitalism. Cronyism is not free market. But inevitably, you'll hear people, a lot of people on the left, and they'll make an argument that, well, no, that is capitalism. That's what happens because, look, we're a capitalist country and cronyism's taking place. But again, that's not a feature of capitalism. Cronyism takes place no matter where you go, right? The idea that certain people are going to seek advantages from the powers that be in government, I don't care if you're a communist regime, a mercantilist regime, a democracy, a republic, free market, I don't care what sort of economic or government system you have. Yes, there's always going to be people to seek to get special privileges from the government. That doesn't mean it's a feature of capitalism. But it is a feature of other economic systems. And this is where it's important to understand the dynamics between how these different economic systems actually function. So within a socialist system, you know, a purely socialist system, the government owns everything. So the way the cronyism takes place is that if you want to get something done or if you want to get a day off, well, then you have to work within the government boundaries and you got to know the right government officials and bureaucrats in order to get what you want, to get more supplies. That's how cronyism takes place within a socialist system. There are two systems, two economic and arguably governmental systems, which cronyism is the dominant feature of the system. One of those economic systems is called mercantilism. Right. And you don't see a lot of this, you know, floating around anymore today. But a perfect example of this would have been like the East India Trading Company out of the United Kingdom, where it was this quasi private public company that had the authority. I mean, for a while there, the East India Company had its own navy. It had its own army. So it operated a lot like a government entity, even though technically it was still private in many respects. That's a mercantilist system. All right. But the other economic system, and this is important, the other economic system that was set up to be deliberately cronyist was fascism. If you look at fascist economic systems, and the two most obvious ones that people generally reference were was Nazi Germany under Hitler and Benito Mussolini and fascist Italy. Both Mussolini and Hitler grew up within the socialist traditions. And if you look what happened when they converted over to fascism, was it's not that they threw out all of socialism. They essentially said that, all right, we're going to allow the private sector to continue to operate in certain areas, right? So they nationalized certain industries. They took them over by the government, just like you would see within a socialist system. But then certain industries they allowed to remain private, provided that those companies did exactly what the government told them to do. So, okay, yeah, you still on some level have private ownership in the means of production. You still on some level have private companies. But how private are you, or how free are you, if your production quotas or what you focus on building is directly in line with whatever the government has told you you have to build, right? So that sort of cronyism, or what they also call cartelization, when you set up cartels of different companies within industries. So you might be keeping some basic level of competition, like really, really superficial, but ultimately these companies are still operating at the behest of the government. They just still have the ability to, you know, determine some of the production mechanisms within the company. But ultimately it's just straight up cronyism. And understand, when you look at the system I've just described, a system where, okay, you still own your company, but if you don't do what the government tells you, and if you don't produce what the government tells you to produce, when they tell you to produce it, at the numbers they tell you to produce, well, then the government's going to come in and they're going to take over your business, right? Again, that falls right in line with how fascist governments ran their economies. Let me ask you something. Does that sound like a conservative approach to the economy? Or does it sound more like what you're hearing come out of the left right now? And I'm not suggesting that, you know, Democrats are fascists. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying when you look at the sort of economic ideas being floated around from everyone from Bernie Sanders to Chuck Schumer to Nancy Pelosi, where you see these kind of veiled threats that if you don't run your business or produce your products that we want you to produce, if you don't fall in line with what the government's telling you to do, well, now we're going to threaten to take you over. Right? I mean, my gosh, I've seen House Democrats make that exact claim. There was one House Democrat out of California that told the oil industry that if it was up to her, they'd be nationalized. That was a veiled threat that they better do what the government wants them to do or actually risk some sort of takeover, right? That's not free market economics. That's not capitalism. That really is kind of a fascist way to govern the economy. And it is an inherently cronyist way to govern the economy. So there's kind of two branches of cronyism, right? One version of cronyism is the government threatening businesses that the only way that they can remain private is if they do what the government wants them to do. The other version of cronyism is where the business comes to the government in order to get some sort of special protections for itself at the expense of its competition. So here's the question. Why do we let it happen? Like, if we can all understand, if we can all look at those examples and we can say, you know what, this isn't the way that we should be doing business on a moral level. It's completely unfair for one company to try to drive out its competition by getting special favors from the government that the other companies don't get. Like, if we can understand that shouldn't happen on a moral level. And if we can even understand on an economic level on why that's not conducive to good market competition, because now that company is no longer focused on serving its customers, that company is focused on servicing politicians, because now it's not so much the consumers that are the primary focus of development and research and things like that. No. They don't need to worry about customers as much as anymore if they can go to the government and have politicians drive out their competition and essentially leave customers nowhere else to go except for that one entity, right? So if we know that that's bad morally, if we know it's bad economically, why does it happen? The reason why it happens is because we have there's an economic concept called concentrated benefits versus dispersed costs. And let me give you an example of how this works. So, you know, you have a particular industry that comes to the government and says, look, we want a tax or a subsidy or a tariff or some sort of regulation to prevent our competition from being able to compete with us in the marketplace. And what ends up happening is that smaller company that was maybe, you know, just starting out but was really innovative, now all of a sudden they can't keep up with all the new government fees. They can't keep up with the new regulations. And so they go out of business or they get bought out by the larger company. Here's what that means for you when you go to the grocery store. So when you go to the grocery store and you buy a product, all right, let's use sugar as an example. The sugar that you buy is now more expensive than it would have otherwise been if you had a free and open competitive market. Not only the sugar, but everything you buy that uses that sugar is also now slightly more expensive. But for you, maybe at the end of the year, maybe every time you go to the grocery store, you're paying, you know, $4 or $5 more than you would have normally paid if there was more open competition, right? I mean, and that's, I'm just throwing out a number, $4 or $5 more than you would have paid. So, you know, over the course of a year, you know, maybe that's, you know, $100 more that you're paying in your grocery bill, but it's $100 over a year, right? You don't even really notice it because you're not open to the competition that could be taking place if this cronyism wasn't actually stunting that competition. So if all it means for you is $100 a year that you don't even really notice, is that going to get you up in arms? Are you going to be like stopping work and calling up your congressman and saying, oh my gosh, why is this cronyism taking place? You know, you need to remove this regulation or remove this subsidy or remove this tariff. Probably not, right? You might find it irritating. You might find it wrong, but it's probably not enough to really get you actively involved in order to roll back that regulation, tax, subsidy, whatever it is. Now let's look at it from the position of that industry. Now, if that industry is making tens of millions of dollars every year by every different shopper out there having to pay a little bit more each time they go to the grocery store, are they motivated to get out and lobby Congress? Oh, you better believe they are. They're going to spend millions protecting that regulation, protecting that tariff, protecting that subsidy, because it is critical for their business. Because otherwise, they would have to compete with all the other producers out there that might be able to offer a better product at a better price. So the concentrated benefit of that tariff or regulation equals tens of millions of dollars for that select industry. It also costs you as the consumer tens of millions of dollars, but you don't feel it as acutely because, again, it's just a little bit more every day on your grocery bill. The problem is that when we expand, that's one example. And you might even say to yourself, you know what, I can live with that. What happens when multiple industries do it? What happens when every time you go to buy a product or get a service, now there's all these hidden costs associated and as a direct result of cronyism, of certain businesses trying to compete unfairly by using government force to drive out their competition, right? That's why I get so frustrated when I hear the term crony capitalism. No, it's either cronyism or it's capitalism. The moment you engage in cronyism, you are working outside the boundaries of free markets, open competition, and you're now using government force in order to force, not only to force your competition out, but to provide a worse scenario for all of your customers, right? Your attention at that point is not on your customers. Your attention on that point is manipulating the marketplace in order to give yourself a competitive advantage. And again, it's bad economically, and quite frankly, it's bad morally. So that's why I have a huge problem with cronyism. And I voted this way in the General Assembly. I've had people come up to me before and go, you know, Nick, why are you voting against this bill? This is going to, you know, quote unquote, bring jobs to Virginia. And I said, well, wait a second. I don't have a problem with tax breaks, but why are you only giving it to one company? Why are you only giving it to one industry? If you can admit that lowering taxes for a business will actually encourage them to hire more and create jobs and provide better products and services at more affordable prices, then why don't we do it for everybody? Why aren't we doing it for this select company because they have more lobbying power than their competitors? Right. And I've had people say, well, but Nick, this is good for business. And I've responded with, no, it's good for a particular business. I want an economic system that actually is good for all businesses, that everyone is able to compete and exchange ideas and work and strive and research and develop in order to make the best product possible. Because the end goal of an efficient and free economy is the efficient use of resources to meet the needs, wants, and demands of the customers. That's what we're shooting for here. And when we have a free market, we're able to do that and that respects property rights. We're able to do that in a responsible way that actually leads to not only greater effectiveness, but greater efficiency. But if all a business has to do in order to get your business is go pay off some politician to drop a bill that they want, are you the customer anymore? Or is the politician the customer? We need to be fighting for an open and free market where the government is not trying to constantly intervene into the economy. Because like I said earlier, PGR Works said it best. Once you put politicians in charge of buying and selling, the first thing to be bought and sold will be politicians. So that's what we should be shooting for. When a politician tells you that something is pro-business, ask the deeper question. What do you mean by that? Is it pro-free market? Is this allowing for greater competition within the marketplace? Is it allowing for new innovators to be able to come up through the system and be able to try out their ideas, to be able to assume risk? And look, sometimes businesses will succeed and sometimes they will fail, but that's all part of the process of the marketplace, not only of goods and services, but the marketplace of ideas. And that's what we want to be able to encourage within our economy. But you can't do it if companies are constantly living in fear of a larger competitor going to the government and getting special privileges at their expense. So let's continue to fight for free markets, not cronyism. Okay, on this segment of Things That Make America Great, we're going to kind of keep with this cronyist component here, and we're going to talk about how someone was able to overcome that and create and produce something incredible. And that's the story of James J. Hill. You know, in the 1850s, going all the way up to the 1890s and the early 20th century, there was this huge push for a transcontinental railroad. And so you had the Central Pacific, you had the Union Pacific, and these railroads got huge land grants, which wasn't necessarily a bad thing. But then they got huge subsidies from the government. I mean, the government was throwing taxpayer dollars at them like you would not believe, because the argument was, is that the only way that you could actually get a transcontinental railroad was you had to have the government actively involved in the process and financing the process. And here's what that led to. It led to, you know, again, horrible cronyism, because now you had these different competing railroads that were fighting over government funds. And the way the government actually wrote the contract was they were getting paid based off of, you know, however many miles of track they laid. Now, you might look at that on a superficial level and say, okay, well, that makes sense. You know, for every mile of track you get laid, you get more government money. Except that, did that provide an incentive for them to lay straight track? No, it didn't. And so they didn't do that. They actually started making all these windy tracks and these windy routes that didn't make a whole lot of sense until you look at the perverse incentive that was created through government cronyism and subsidization. You saw just huge problems within both of those different railroad companies, where you had bribery of public officials, you had embezzlement, you had horrible treatment of Native American populations along the line of track, you had horrible treatment of workers. I mean, it was, you know, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And it took a great deal of government oversight, several bankruptcies before these tracks were able even to line up. And even then, you had people going to jail for years after this, based off of, again, bribery, misappropriation of government funds, fraud, embezzlement. It was a nightmare. But everyone was convinced, well, that's the only way you're going to get it done. And then James J. Hill comes along, and he decides, and he had done a lot of work up in the northern portion of the country in Canada with trading posts and things of that nature. He'd kind of come from very humble beginnings, and he saw that there was a need for a track to go from St. Paul, Minnesota to Seattle, Washington. He didn't get any government subsidies. The only thing he got was some of the government land grants, which, again, I don't have as big a problem with that, because the government shouldn't have been owning all that land anyways. They should have been selling it off to private people that could then go and use it for productive purposes. But because James J. Hill wasn't relying on government subsidies, he had all this freedom with how he was able to operate. Instead of calling in the cavalry every time he had a problem or a conflict with Native American populations, he was able to negotiate with them for land purchases. When it came to things like how he laid the track, he had to make sure it was good construction, because there was no government money to come in and bail him out time and again if he screwed it up the first time. He had private investors that would hold him accountable if he didn't do a good job. So he laid straight track, he laid sturdy track, he made sure that the stop-offs made a lot of sense. When he ran into different areas, he didn't try using the government to force people to do what he wanted. He would divert his track over to another area that was far more welcoming, and they received the economic benefits by having a railroad close by. He was able to run this railroad successfully and profitably for years. When there was problems with other railroads, and they had to adjust their prices, they would run and try to get a government subsidy. Hill didn't do that. He found more efficient ways to carry cargo and passengers to where he could actually provide lower fares than his competition. And so he could encourage people to continue to ride, while at the same time, he found efficient and innovative ways to be able to work with local businesses and agriculture, mining, et cetera, to be able to get goods and products and services to the places they needed to be in order to be the most profitable. So he just blew the lid off this idea that the only way that we could do something really big with railroads codes at that time was if the government was coming in and just showering people in tax dollars. He proved that with sound investment, good planning, peaceful and voluntary cooperation with people, economic efficiency, you could make that line profitable and good, not only for business, but also for the people that were moving westward during that time and setting up new lives in an unexplored, largely unexplored West. So James J. Hill is just another perfect example of an entrepreneur in America coming from humble beginnings, seeing an opportunity, taking a risk, pushing back against government subsidies, and proving that he could make it work for the betterment, not only of himself, but for millions of people that were able to use that line to get goods, services, and people all where they needed to go. So James J. Hill, another perfect example of somebody working together, voluntary cooperation to make America a greater place. Okay, that is all the time we have today. I want to thank you again for joining us here on Making the Argument. Please consider leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're getting this right now. Also, we have a video component to this, so if you'd like to go to YouTube and check out our channel there as well, please do. Leave us some comments. Let us know the sort of topics you'd like to see in the future. And again, thank you for dropping by and spending the time with us. Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.